Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line, prop or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Hello listeners, I'm your speaker Casey and welcome to this week's episode of The Cult Vault. I'm sure by now you may have figured that my podcast has taken a slightly different direction. It's grown from me researching well-known sects to me interviewing survivors from lesser-known movements and giving a platform for those people to finally be heard. That is why I'm excited to bring you this week's episode with Luna. Luna was part of a Christian youth church turned cult. Listen to her extensive retelling of her time within this small congregation that used cult-like methods of control on its young and susceptible members. As always, I quickly wanted to bring your attention to my Patreon. You can support my podcast today from as little as £1 a month. Head on over to patreon.com/thecultvault. And thank you again to those amazing people who are already over here supporting. Before we begin Luna's interview, I just wanted to add a quick trigger warning of sexual abuse, so please listen with discretion. And now, here is Luna. So hi, Luna, and thank you so much for agreeing to appear on my podcast today. I'm really excited to finally get to listen more in depth to your story. And I know that you've been doing some of your own research as well, which I'm really excited to listen to. So would you like to start by introducing yourself to our listeners and telling us a little bit about who you are and what you're up to?
Yeah, absolutely. So I go by Luna, and you know, thank you for having me. This entire experience has been really healing, and thank you for being part of that. So far lately, I've been just working from home. I have this dream of having a homestead, so I've been working on learning how to grow my own food and raise animals and such, and so I'm having a lot of fun with that.
That sounds absolutely amazing. I tried to grow some greens over the summer. Yeah. It didn't go very well. No. I think I managed to grow one successful onion and a loads of raspberries that that all of the insects got to before I had a chance. So hopefully you'll be a lot more successful than I was in that venture. And so specifically, we're here to talk today about your experience growing up in a Christian church. Just tell the listeners a little bit about the church's beliefs and what age you joined and that sort of thing.
So this church officially, I guess, started off non-denominational, and then it became more of a Pentecostal church. It was very intentional to be non-denominational, I think, and they were very clear about it. I think it was speaking about being non-denominational. A lot of the rhetoric that was used was, you know, other churches getting so caught up in theology was wrong, And in the end, we just need to love Jesus and we just need to believe in him. But then it started turning a little bit more Pentecostal, which is, you know, the believing in the Holy Trinity, casting out demons. It became more of that culture. And we as far as like what kind of buildings we were predominantly low-income members. And so was the pastor. And so we moved around a lot. Collectively, we didn't have a lot of money. And so we met at many different places, hotel meeting rooms, reception halls. At one point we were in a public park, meeting each other's homes. I think at one point we were at a warehouse building. And so I actually left the day of the inauguration of the building that was meant to be permanent. But that place is also not a thing anymore. It's a dollar store now. So okay. That's pretty satisfying.
I was going to say, that's pretty poignant if that's the case. You're like, oh, we're finally going to get a place to stay and this is where I'm going to dip out. Interesting.
It was crazy. Yeah. It was a crazy feeling because I even spent my entire spring break renovating the place. Wow. And just working in, you know, no AC and the heat of South Texas and
wow.
Just, you know, working hard physically. And I was just, you know, a senior in high school. So now it's a dollar store. I helped build this dollar store. So this dollar store now it was in rough areas of Texas. And the pastor himself said that he did purposefully stay around this area because it was for outreach, because, you know, so that people wouldn't travel far to get to church, because we were supposed to be reaching out to people that were more like us, that were from the areas that we grew up in.
Right. And when you talk about we as a collective, was your family involved in this? Did your parents attend the church?
Yeah. My complete household, immediate family went to this church. My dad was a handyman and he fixed a leak in someone's house. And his customer asked him to go to church with us, if we could go to his church. And my parents and I went one day. I think it was like a Wednesday service, and it was very youth oriented. You know, the lights were off and they had crazy lights and the music was a little bit more modern and there was young people all around and the atmosphere was, you know, aimed at young people. And so my parents decided to continue going for the sake of us, because I have two other siblings that were growing up with me as well. So they did later told me about how they never felt welcome there as adults and they felt uneasy being there. But, you know, growing up in such a bad area, my parents were also feeling very uneasy about the possibility of me being influenced by gangs and violence and the things that you're susceptible to when you live in these areas. So filling in your time with church was definitely a better alternative compared mm-hmm. to what could have happened. And so, for all I know, things could have been worse for me in my life. So I am grateful for their choices.
It sounds as though your parents, you know, just had the best for you in mind.
Right.
Were they religious before this? Were you attending a different type of church at all?
So my mom started going to church when I was a toddler, and we would go in Mexico. So the churches over there were, you know, straight up Pentecostal, and it was a common thing. You know, I remember being a toddler and being taken to the church and every Sunday, and really long services and the classic, you know, jumping around and in the Holy Spirit. And it was all normal for me. And my parents were aware of that. And I think, you know, the pastor of this church specifically pushed away my parents, but at the same time kept them close, because they, once he started turning more Pentecostal, switching into that gear, my parents, I think, came into play a lot more because they knew more about it or had actual experience, whereas the pastor didn't at all. The only experience he had was books that he read, and he read a lot. So that's what, you know, happened there. Around this time, I was about 12 or 13. So it was a very malleable and susceptible age.
Okay. Okay. So you moved from Mexico over to Texas.
Yeah. I moved from, as far as church goes. Yeah. Because before we went to this church, we would go to a you know, big giant mega church here in Texas, and we didn't feel very homey. And that's pretty typical in a church like that, just because it's so big and it's difficult to feel that connection with people. So we went there for a very long time, but in the end we ended up with this church. It was a lot smaller. I think at the time it was like maybe 50 to 70 members,
and it was made up mostly of young people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And was there a name for the church or the gathering, or did it just remain nameless?
No, I guess I'll tell you the church. It was called Present Truth Mission.
Right. Okay.
So it was, a lot of us went by it for, it was PTM. So all of us called it PTM.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And do you feel like it was common for other adults within the congregation to also feel unwelcome?
Yeah. Yeah. I think that growing up there, I remember listening to the adults, you know, the moms talk about it, and saying that they wanted their own group to get together with because they didn't feel, you know, they didn't say I didn't feel welcome, because obviously that would be bashing the church and that would be unacceptable, but they would say, you know, we need something for ourselves. And, you know, speaking with my mom now, she was never allowed to be involved in any extracurricular activities. She was never considered to be someone that might have any leadership skills. She was essentially a ride for me and my siblings. And, you know, she's expected to sit and be quiet, and she didn't, you know, she wasn't encouraged to give anybody advice, even though she was an older mom mm-hmm. that might be able to provide these young people some advice. And I definitely do believe that many, many adults and parents didn't feel as welcome as their sons and daughters were, for sure.
I suppose it would be difficult to know as well on the surface whether it was because she's a woman or whether because she's an adult.
The pastor had a thing. Yeah, it was definitely a gender was involved for sure, because there was a lot of older men. There was at one point, you know, single moms and such, but the older men, I don't know, they did get together themselves. I mean, they played soccer, they'd have barbecues, so they were kind of, you know, nonchalant part of the church. Mm-hmm. But I do believe they were suppressed as well, mm-hmm. and kept out of the way.
Okay. And what did the average day or week look like for you as a practicing member of this church?
It was exhausting. Sunday was the main service, which is a classic service. We would have worship and have a main preaching. And then Mondays were leadership meetings. They're very exclusive. You can only get invited to those. Tuesdays, just as an example, they would be a T group, which is short for transformation group. At one point, it used to be called the cell group. I do think they would change the names of these meetings to kind of add a sense of change and sort of forward motion. But as people, we were always, I feel we were either running in place or running around in circles. So I think that was the pastor's way of making us feel like we were moving forward, but we never did. We were assigned these T groups and cell group leaders. We could not choose for ourselves. On Wednesdays, It was a middle of the week kind of service. The leader specifically did say that it was to carry us through to Sunday, because Monday and Tuesday were probably days that we were getting tempted from worldly people. We were probably getting discouraged. So Wednesdays were necessary so that it could carry us through to Sunday. I remember for a very long time, Thursdays were my only free day, but that could easily get filled in by extracurricular activities, you know, such as like dancing, skits, songs that you might write, which I did a lot of. And Fridays, for a very long time, we had something called night vigils, which is, you know, we would literally pray from sundown to sunup. Saturdays, we often socialize together. One of the people that I spoke with let me know that, you know, she figured out that it was a cult, because when she was excommunicated, she didn't end up having any friends to have support with. And one of the other people, I'm just going to read what she sent me. She says, the friends I had there were good, sweet, kind, loyal, and overall the best anyone could ask for. I'd open up to these friends in so many ways, and then me. There was such a close bond with one another. And I definitely resonate with that a lot. Because when you do leave these places, you are left very, very lonely, and it's very, very painful and confusing, because you think that you're gonna have these friends for life, and you end up being alienated away from everyone, and it's not a very easy thing to go through. Which sometimes, you know, I hear people say, "Well, why didn't you just leave if it was that bad?" You know, I mean, your entire livelihood, all of your friends are there with you, and you don't have anything outside of it. And so, Saturdays was socializing together. We often went to movies and played sports, did barbecues, and back around to Sunday. It was really exhausting.
So you mentioned that you had a service on Wednesday, which was to keep you from straying or temptation. But you did mention that there were activities available on Monday, Tuesday. So you actually gave an example of something you could be involved in every single day of the week.
Yeah, for sure. Easily. I mean, we constantly felt like there wasn't enough time to get all of this in. And we were constantly tired and exhausted because we, you know, you... If you can act, then you better be doing skits for the church. If you can sing, you better be doing, you better be singing for the church. And so the days that your transformation group or your cell group wasn't meeting, you often would meet with the group of people that were in that niche, essentially, and would practice singing or acting or whatever. And so very, very easily that day would get taken up, because I often only had one day to work with, and that wasn't enough for me.
And did this mean that you didn't have any social groups or hobbies outside of the church?
I didn't at all. I was lucky enough to be able to be involved in I was in ROTC, so I was in a drill team, and I worked around it. Church was my priority, so I had to work around it. I often missed a lot of practice. Thankfully, my sergeant was very understanding of it. So I did get to have that, but I definitely worked that pastime around the church. It right. was never to be the other way around, because if we didn't show up to one of the services, we would always be approached by the leadership, either by the pastor or by our leader or anybody else in the church, because we were encouraged to keep each other accountable. So if we were to not show up, it would be taken very seriously and considered to be, you know, you're falling away from God. And it wasn't acceptable.
Okay. And when you talk about, church was your priority, did you take that responsibility upon yourself? You didn't have your parents saying, "Oh, don't forget you have this service and this commitment and this with the church on Wednesday, Thursday."
Absolutely, because we were taught, you know, first of all, I'm a bigger sister. I'm the oldest of all my siblings. So in this congregation, we were very much about leadership. And so, you know, who was that? Why would I, how could I call myself a leader or an aspiring leader if I couldn't keep track of myself? And so right. I remember when I would prioritize church over ROTC and the drill team, I proudly did it. You know, I enthusiastically did it because I wanted to prove and show that I did want to, I did prioritize God because nothing takes the place of God. Mm-hmm. He's always number one in your life. And so I always did it on my own accord. No one had to keep me accountable in that sense.
And did you go to a typical school for someone your age?
Yeah, I went to a public high school.
And did anybody find it strange that you had such a commitment to your church? Because I know that Texas is, and those areas of America are heavy on religion. So was it just seen as normal for somebody your age to be that dedicated to church events?
Yes. I definitely wasn't normal. I think even if I wasn't in a cult, I think I'd still be a weird kid in high school. So just to top it off, you know, I was very enthusiastic about church. And so we were constantly being told to talk about God in everything and everyone that we encountered. So I did end up alienating myself at school due to constantly trying to invite people to church. And I like to convince myself that I chose not to have friends. And then sometimes I did reject certain friendships because they were worldly and I was not. And so, you know, as one of the people that I spoke with, you know, we were taught to shove Jesus down their throat. Mm-hmm. And so one of the members I spoke with too, she said that she knew in hindsight that it was a cult because, you know, she didn't have any friends and she would do that to herself even willingly. Mm-hmm. And even proud, you know, I'm proud that I get alienated because, you know, you get persecuted. If you're a Christian that truly loves God, you're going to get persecuted in this society because this society is evil and, they followed their flesh more than they did anything else. And they love themselves more than anything else. And so they're vain. And so it makes sense that you would get rejected because Jesus himself got rejected. Why wouldn't you? You know, it's an honor to get rejected the same way that Jesus did. And so I definitely believe I could have had a lot more friendships in growing up in high school than I did now. I mean, I remember when I graduated and I walked the stage, you know, everybody's kind of cheering everybody on and some people get more cheers than others because, you know, they're popular or whatever. And man, when I went across that stage, there was like crickets playing to me. Like I remember like waving at my classmates and I remember specific looks of like, who is she? Or, you know, not even recognizing me because I went out of my way to stay away from these people. And, you know, it makes sense that they would have that reaction. And it was a sad experience for me walking through that stage, but I am so much more stronger for it.
Yeah. I think a lot of people that I've spoken to, they tend to have these experiences where they are alienated from their peer group. Mm-hmm. But at the time that it unfolds or the time that it happens, they're happy with that situation because they know what the rest of these people don't know, that right. they're going to be saved, that they're part of the superior movement, that they're going to be the ones that are going to be chosen when the end times come, or, you know, when everybody needs to, when Armageddon arrives. And it's funny that some of the people I've spoken to were like, well, I didn't mind if I was left out of, you know, my peer groups get togethers or picked last in gym class because I was going to heaven and I knew the rest of them weren't. So I just felt sad and sorry for them that, you know, they weren't going to be saved. And then, you know, and a lot of people I've spoken to said that that's a hard pill to swallow when you come out of your movement because you realize that you're just the same as everybody else.
Yeah, I think you know, once you come out of that, it's such a toxic environment, you know, you could even, because you're encouraged to kind of put yourself down. So whenever you come out of that situation, you could even say that you're not just like everybody else, you're worse. You're worse than them, because the Bible did, you know, it talks about, you know, being lukewarm, and God would spit you out if you were lukewarm. So, you know, if you were to leave and come back, if you were to be in the church and leave and try to come back, it was worse than if a person would get saved for the first time.
Right.
You know, we were hypocrites. And if, you know, I experienced that myself, where I felt like I was worse than someone that has never been saved in the church, because now I know what I know, and yet I'm out here in this world, you know, doing what I want with my life. And it was very toxic for myself. I actually became very suicidal after I left. And it became an uphill battle for me to forgive myself, because I did have a holier than thou attitude. I did think I was better. I did have a snotty attitude, and I felt like I had a right to it, because it was the end all be all, you know. It wasn't even just my religion was the right religion. It was my church is the church, mm-hmm. you know, any other church outside of us, even if they were Pentecostal, non-denominational, agreed with us 100% in our theologies at the time, we still had a sense of, we felt sorry for them. And the pastor, you know, did often talk down on these other congregations, as, you know, if we were to come to a church, we would walk in feeling a sense of like, we're here to help you. We're yeah. here to bless you, and you're welcome, you know, and you should be thankful that we're mm-hmm. here and that we chose you. And that was sort of imprinted on us. And, you know, even though, yeah, the pastor did drill that into our heads, I think we are all individually responsible for taking on that attitude and taking advantage letting us ourselves seep in that pride in our belief that we are better than other people. Because if we did follow the Bible, and if we did follow Jesus's character and aspire to be like him, there is none of that of him,
yeah.
you know, in him that we could mirror. And so mm-hmm. it was very selfish of us to feel that way. And we were also in denial about it. You know, we didn't realize at the time that we did feel holier than thou. And, you know.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line, prop, or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
The future is a hefty responsibility, and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Our chests were puffed up and our chins were up like that. You know, we didn't see it that way. And later on, it's kind of like a train hitting you, how much you realize you know, you push people away, you judge people, and you hurt people, because happily, you know, people would get excommunicated and they would happily get rid of their relationships, you know, their friendships, their own family, you know, they would happily do something like that for the kingdom and be proud of it, you know? And it reminded me of the soldiers in the Holocaust, when all of that was happening, how the soldiers had a taste of power. And, you know, in the end, they were trying to justify their actions by saying, we were just following orders, you know? And I could say, well, Pastor, to put that in me, but I still pulled the trigger. I still looked them in the face and chose how to torture these people. I still judged people, and I hold that responsibility for my actions, because the pastor wasn't there, you know, literally forcing me to do any of these things. And we chose to accept these things as the truth, you know, that we were better than other people.
Yeah, I think it's also important to remember, though, that if you were to turn up to somebody else's congregation and say, I'm here to help you, that it's likely that they would have exactly the same attitude.
Yeah, I never felt that way about other people. But we didn't, I mean, it's not like we congregated with different other churches very often, you know, maybe two churches that I remember that we might have mingled with, two or three. Maybe they did feel that way, but it wasn't so blatant.
Right. Okay.
But, you know, for all I know, they were just happy to hang out with us and to, you know, maybe learn from each other. For all I knew, their attitudes were in their right mind. What I do know is what my attitude was about it, for sure.
And you've talked a lot about the pastor, and you've talked a bit about the leaders of the church as well. So are these the people that oversee the entire operation?
I mean, yes. But I mean, for the most part, the pastor was in charge.
And was it the same pastor the whole time you were part of this congregation?
Yeah, he was. At one point, the pastor no longer preached the main service. I didn't know why, but it was because he was caught harassing and abusing women in the church. The deacon, which was the right-hand man of the pastor, was on paper officially made to be the pastor of the congregation. And I think this was done so that if things escalated into legalities of maybe taking the church away from him, on paper, you know, there was no church to take away from the pastor, because he wasn't technically the pastor, although he remained in control. He did introductions, outroductions on Sundays, every other service throughout the week that we had, you know, and he made the decisions in the church. You know, this deacon, right-hand man of the pastor, was just the pastor on paper. But this pastor remained in control. And essentially, you know, the structure was, you know, the pastor, and then it was the pastor's wife. There were deacons, which essentially the idea, I guess, of deacons or elders or whatever you want to call them, they're supposed to make decisions for the church with the pastor, sort of like, you know, how you would have a board of,
board of directors type of arrangement.
Right. Mm-hmm. That collectively make the decision together. There's even voting involved, but they weren't, you know, they were just one level up. And then there were leaders who had their own transformation groups or cell groups. And then after that, there were members of the church. And then there were visitors of the church. There was a very clear distinction between members and visitors. So, but essentially, I mean, the pastor always stayed in control. The leaders were kind of just, you know, I think it was like a treat, like the way I treat my dog, and I give him a treat because he did good, you know, hey, you get to be a leader or a deacon because you did
right,
good.
Yeah, okay. You're useful to me. So if you're in favor with the pastor, you're given more responsibility or leadership roles. And that's what you mentioned towards the beginning of our conversation, that's what you strive towards in the church. Mm-hmm. So
yeah, that,
the pastor was accused of harassing and abusing other female members of the church. Are these adult women?
Yeah, there was that I know of, they were all adults except for one that I know of.
Okay, and you also mentioned that he's married, so I'm going to assume that the abuse isn't sexual abuse.
No, it was very sexual abuse.
Right, okay.
So as far as this is where I collected a lot of the stories.
Right.
I literally have these notes for you.
That's just really interesting that he was accused by these women of this abuse. And even though they changed the name on paper, he was still running the congregation.
Yeah.
That just surprises me so much.
Really? So people that you would speak with, this wouldn't happen as often? Is this more rare?
Yeah, I mean it happens. For example, at the moment I'm talking a lot with ex Jehovah's Witnesses, and they've spoken a lot about the elders in their congregation who I've spoken to ex Jehovah's Witnesses from 4 different parts of the world so far, and it seems to be they operate in a very universal way, which all the listeners will get to find out during October, which is completely dedicated to Jehovah's Witnesses. Mm. But there seems to be a lot of physical abuse or sexual abuse or harassment or bullying that is basically swept under the rug. So it's always able to be disproven, or the elders come together and they will almost investigate internally what the problem is, so that if it was ever to be spoken about outside of that specific congregation, they would know the facts and details to make sure that it couldn't be proven. So just with the Jehovah's Witnesses particularly, even if there were allegations, the elders would never step down because, you know, they feel safe enough with the knowledge that it's their word against one or two people of the congregation, and the elders hold all of the power within the Jehovah's Witnesses, within particular congregations anyway. So yeah, with that movement particularly, that happens. And then with other movements, like people I've spoken to who have lived in communes, you know, sort of outside of the realm of everyday life for a typical person, there is nobody to whistleblow to. There is nobody to, you know, there's no authorities around. The communities are self-policed. Mm. So if anything happens, if there's an infraction, you would usually go and tell the leadership of that movement, who, you know, as long as they have full control of their group, wouldn't really be too bothered about, or themselves are the ones carrying out the abuse.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. I mean, it's just I've heard of a few examples. I think even with Jim Jones and the People's Temple, there was he'd avoided tax for so long that he had actually asked a member of his church to have the People's Temple signed over to his name, so that when they did actually get audited, this person who had signed those documents ended up losing, you know, his home and all
so
that.
So they
stuff.
Had these, you know, these safety nets. Yeah, for sure. I think, you know, I think that the women that were abused by this pastor, I think they were particularly strong and brave women that did not seize for as long as they could until they got what they wanted. And I, you know, they definitely didn't get everything that they wanted, but we're not done yet. So I think that the way this church kept all of this quiet, a big factor of it was power. And so, you know, this pastor figured out what was your weakness, and then he exploited it to the max, used it against you to the max. And so, you know, many leaders in this congregation left the church because they couldn't handle knowing all of this information, but they told no one about what they knew about.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when they did go to other congregations, they would tell these other leaders in different churches half stories, just whatever sounded beneficial, whatever didn't make them look complicit to, you know, covering up what the pastor was doing at that time.
Right.
And it was, it was power. It was the taste of power, knowing that you have power over people and their lives and their decisions, because every aspect of our lives are controlled by them. I think that, you know, it was something that they liked very much, and for it to be taken away from them was something they couldn't let go. And the reason why I say that is because I feel like if I would have been one of those leaders that found out from one of the people that were under me that, you know, they were sexually or mentally abused by the pastor, I'm not going to claim that I'm better than any of them. I feel like I might feel particularly inclined to keep my mouth shut about it, at least for some time, because power is, the Holocaust, you know, it's a powerful thing. And when people receive that, especially when, you know, we grow up in these toxic homes, we're broken people. I mean, you know, statistically speaking, where we grew up and who we are as a community, we grew up in these really rough areas of Texas. And so a lot of us, statistically speaking, we were, for example, very fatherless congregations. We were encouraged to gain members the same that we were. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, like one of the people that I spoke with, you know, she said, it wasn't long before my parents were starting to get concerned. They didn't like the fact that my pastors explained to them that they felt like my spiritual parents. Not once in my ignorance had I realized that many of my friends had broken families or parents that simply threw them to the wind. They were the ones that needed parents, not me. I already had two. Both my parents were loving and caring and Christians and brought me up in a Christian household. So, you know, another one said, I think a lot of the young people stayed there, that, you know, the young people that stayed there stayed for a long time because they wanted to be seen and validated by a father figure.
Yeah.
So the pastors had so much power to sway each and every one of them. And I definitely believe I was one of these young people because, you know, my parents had me at a very young age and they ended up not being together. And I have a dad and I also have a stepdad, and you know, as healthy as you can make this be, there's going to be father issues involved. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I definitely felt like this, you know, reading back on my messages with this pastor, this guy really exploited that about me and how I felt like, alone. Like I didn't know who was my father and I didn't know, you know, I was angry at my dad, but you know, he did what he could and he showed up when he could and he visited me and we talked and he did everything that a dad should do, in these situations. But, I think that the pastor definitely fed into me being fatherless and feeling rejected, mm-hmm. and made it grow in me to despise my dad and hate my stepdad as well. And then he was the only father that didn't do me wrong. And so if you combine my weakness of feeling fatherless with the fact that he's my only father figure in my life, you know, if I were to learn that he was sexually abusing another woman, I would be more inclined to believe him when he denied it, or mm-hmm. I would be more inclined to protect him when these things came to light, and be involved in, you know, covering it up.
I think that's, you know, it's a good time to say how commendable and strong the women are for coming forward, because it is often that, you know, the pastor will be believed. Like I mentioned with the Jehovah's Witnesses, you know, if one person comes forward and says, I've been abused by an elder, there's four or five elders to a church that will say, well, actually, that's not true. And then everybody believes the elders because they're the ones in charge, you know, the Jehovah speaks through them. I'm sure, you know, you saw your pastor as the person who was delivering God's message to you. So you believe the leader, you believe the person, you have so much trust in them. So it's a very important, and it's incredible that these women have found a voice and been able to come forward and fight for justice and actually have their stories be listened to and be able to say, this happened, I'm telling the truth, something needs to happen, and we're not going to stop until it does. So that's fantastic. And as a woman myself, obviously, I'm always going to be an advocate for women's rights, and I'm going to advocate for women to have voices and be listened to. So hopefully there'll be some positive results that come from people having to relive these horrible experiences. So we can wait on and see on that. But I've just made a note here as you were talking about an episode I released a couple of weeks ago about people with narcissistic personality disorders. Mm-hmm. And I can see a lot of those traits that I researched and read about coming through about your pastor, particularly. Because with somebody that has narcissistic personality disorder, they have a way of commanding the people around them to want to do as much as they can to please that person. Yeah. So it sounds almost like yourself and other members of the church would go to the furthest lengths possible to make him happy, to make sure that you weren't stepping out of line, to make sure that you were doing everything that you thought he might want from a church member. Is that kind of how you'd feel about it as well?
Yeah, it's funny that you say that, because I was speaking with someone about it, and they kept calling him a narcissist, and I didn't exactly know what that meant. So then, you know, typical me, I listened to about 10 podcasts about narcissism, so my brain was filled with what a narcissist would be. Mm-hmm. And yeah, he definitely meets a lot of the criteria as a narcissist, you know, and even the people that I spoke with talked about it. You know, in my opinion, he does remind me of Charles Manson. This guy was really small and short, super insecure, and also, you know, not the most handsome person. He was very educated. He read a lot of books. He was very charismatic. He knew how to speak to people. I mean, he knew how to manipulate people. But I think a lot of this was, and like one of the people I spoke with, you know, they said people start ministries having a lot of trauma, and that was his problem. He, you know, from one of the women that I got to speak with, she knew him from the previous church that he was at, you know, before he started his own church,
and he left his
bad terms. Based off of what this woman told me about him, was he wasn't liked very much by this church because he was as promiscuous as he was, you know, during running his church, and he would, you know, run around and harass the women, and the pastor at his church didn't tolerate it from him, and so he left on his own because he kept getting in trouble for it. And so he left with the woman he ended up marrying, and I think at one point he was convincing himself that he was doing good because it was a church that he had started, and maybe he did have good intentions, but you know, a lot of the women and people that I spoke with believed, you know, maybe I do, and I believed this for a very, very long time until I started doing my research and speaking with people about it. Many people believe that this church was began, including myself, with good intentions, and then it just evolved into something, you know, horrible. Mm-hmm. But the truth is, the horridness began with this man's youth, with his own childhood trauma, with his own, you know, narcissistic roots that he himself has his identity with. And so it was never a good place to be in from the start, because the head of the church was compromised in that sense. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it's really sad, because I think it was a little bit comforting for me to tell myself, oh, we started off good, but then it evolved really bad. Well, I mean, one of the first women that he harassed, you know, that we know of, was just, you know, in the beginning of the church starting. And then, you know, before that, in the previous church he was, you know, he was running around harassing women the same. And so where's the root of it? At this point, you're already getting to his teenage years. So that comfort was taken from me, but it helped me understand where this guy is coming from. And, you know, the fact that he was super insecure about himself, and you know, he was really short guy, and I'm really tall, I'm 5'10". So this guy would like stand literally stand up on a chair to look down on me.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it was really funny. And then he would, the way he would stand, he could not pull his chest up and his chin up enough. Like he, for the sake of look, because he's short, so for the sake of looking down on you, he would pull his chin up towards you and look you down through, like,
I'm
you
just
know,
picturing like eye. A meerkat, you know, like when they come out of the hole and they stand on the top of the hill. And they are on their hind legs and they're looking up. That's what I'm picturing.
Yeah. No, yeah, just thinking about it. I mean, and he would do like things like power. I was talking to one of the girls and she reminded me of how he was, and he would do these like power grips on you when he would shake your hand. And then, you know, he would shake your hand and then he would grip you real hard and pull you right to him. And he would do things like, you know, point his finger at your forehead and you know, he would say things like, "Don't be tripping, sister." Like, he was really just very, very narcissistic. He was constantly asking women, you know, how he, you know, that he, how they thought he looked, like if he was handsome or attractive in any way. And, I mean,
he's
this guy
looking,
is super,
yeah, it sounds like he's just searching for kind of any sort of confirmation. It sounds as though this person in particular, I've just finished covering part one of the Branch Davidians and talking about David Koresh as a cult leader. And he himself, you know, he felt entitled growing up, that he deserved more with his life. It's the same with Ted Bundy. You know, he grew up feeling as though he was missing out something. He suffered with throughout his childhood because he was, you know, he didn't know who his father was, and he grew up being a quote bastard child in a quite a well-off area, which tormented him, I think, and he felt entitled to some level of power. And it sounds as though the trauma that your pastor encountered when he was growing up made him feel like, you know, he deserved more. He deserved power. A lot of people that self-proclaim that they are, you know, that they've seen a prophecy or that, you know, they are the second coming of Christ. A lot of these people, you can go back and trace severe mental health issues growing up or, you know, almost like PTSD that they're suffering from some extreme trauma from their childhood. So I think, you know, when he gets almost not kicked out but feels as though he has to leave this last church and then finds the church that you become a part of, it's mostly children, it's mostly young people who are susceptible to somebody that speaks intelligent language and sounds like they really know what they're talking about and promises you that they can take you to places and show you places that nobody else can.
Absolutely.
And so you're with this person who, you know, has made these promises to you. You'll do anything for that person. And then finally, he's found that place that he's always been looking for, that place he feels like he deserves, you know, that gives him that level of power that he can, you know, abuse people from that power because he's at the top of the hierarchy, which is, I'm just speculating here. Obviously, I'm not an expert in any sense of the word. I'm just going by things I've read and other people I've spoken to and historical cases that I've read about. But that kind of feels like that's the sense I'm getting from this person without having met him before.
Absolutely. It gives me a little bit of a satisfaction to know that there's a name for him, and he's not that unique. He's just someone that really, really needed a good, I guess, leadership in his life and someone that, you know, helped him through his trauma. He just needed really good therapy and he might've been a good guy. I mean, obviously he's very talented in the way he spoke and, you know, and he would specifically tell us too, you know, to reach out to these people that were like us. And it wasn't just low-income people, but it was, you know, we were uneducated. Many of us dropped out of school, you know, gang members. We had all kinds of people in this church that even weren't as educated. And he, you know, he might've been intimidating in that sense. He would go out of his way to tell us, don't bring me any people that were already Christians before. Like, don't bring those people over here. They've had their chance already. I want babies. He would say that. I want Christian babies. I want them to be fresh and new, so that I can teach them the right way. And that was, that's definitely, I mean, anybody that, and I spoke to several people that, you know, had experience with, you know, even particularly one of the women there, she had family members who were pastors, and she stayed there a very short time. And she did share with me, you know, from my experience before I ended up in PTM, all kinds of red flags were just flying around because of the way that he acted. It was very inappropriate. But none of us other people caught it because we had never experienced church outside of what we were in. Mm-hmm. And so that was very much done intentionally. And I remember in that sense, he reminds me a lot of Jim Jones. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, I'm sure you listen to the recordings of Jim Jones because he liked to record his stuff. You know, he was always saying, I'm sick of all of this. I'm sick of you. And, you know, the reasoning behind him becoming a cult leader was not really that he had a passion. I think he just loved feeding into his need for people to approve of him. And, you know, I just last night at like 1:30 in the morning, I'm reading through the messages, and I found a conversation that I had with him where him and I argued about, you know, why would he make you a pastor if you don't like being a pastor? Yeah. And why would God make you do that? And he's like, well, you know, I don't question God. I just do as he tells me. And I'm like, it doesn't make any sense. You know, for example, if I have a talent of being able to write and sing, why wouldn't I be using my talent of writing and singing for the good of people, for God, you know, to help people? It doesn't make sense that I would have this talent to be thrown away. And in the same way, why would God do that to us, to where he would make us be something that we're not passionate about? I don't think God operates that way. Mm-hmm. And he would contradict himself too, because he would tell us that we were stealing from the church if we didn't use our talents and abilities in the church. And so, you know, I would tell him, like, if you don't like being a pastor, why are you one? And, you know, he would say that he was just being obedient to God, and just doing what God was telling him to do. But, you know, yeah, I definitely agree with you. He was just there because he got, you know, one of the girls that I would listen to on YouTube would say that he got, you know, his narcissism was being fed in this environment. And so this is the environment he chose, because this is how he could continue to be a narcissist and fly under the radar and feed his narcissism with the power trips that he would have and the control and the approval and people looking up to him the way that we did, for sure.
So you've spoken a lot about his leadership style, and if you were to step out of line from the way that the pastor liked the church to be run, would there be any consequences to that?
For sure. We would get sat down, or we would be put on discipline. And one of the people that I spoke with, I'm just going to quote her because she did a beautiful job. It says, the definition of being put on discipline or getting sat down was a member couldn't serve in any way, shape, or form. All extracurricular was banned, and he or she was not allowed to pray for others or lay hands on people. And so, you know, even for a while, I remember that the ushers would leave the front row open so that the people on discipline could sit there, because they're the ones that really needed to receive the word of God when he would be preaching. If you know, for example, I would get sat down so much because I constantly questioned things. And it wasn't because there was no malicious intent. I didn't like being rebellious. In fact, I hated that about myself, that I questioned so many things. But, you know, I would catch things that would contradict themselves within the church. And I would just ask, you know, I really just wanted clarity. I'm 15, 16 years old around this time. I've been in church for years at this point. I would never dare to question what they had to say. I was just curious as to what, you know, why are these things contradicting themselves? Because I was so eager to know these things and fill my head with knowledge of these things. And so they would get really upset with me and frustrated with me. And I would get sat down a lot. So I, you know, for example, for me, I used to sing and write music. And so if I were to mess up in that way, I would get sat down and I would have to just go through a period of having to just, I just need to receive the word and I just need to pay attention and I better be taking notes. Literally, that was a big thing. We had to be taking notes, like carry a notebook and a pen. And we were even told to carry extra paper and pens so that if you see one of your brothers and sisters not taking notes, you better, you know, be the one to hand one to them. And so you better sit there, take notes, receive the word. And then, you know, if once they felt like it was appropriate, they would go ahead and let you go back to what you were doing.
Right, right.
This is where I'm going to leave part one today. But if you are eager to listen to the rest of Luna's story, don't worry because part two is available now. Get in touch at cultvaultpodcast@gmail.com or follow me on Twitter and Instagram at cultvaultpod. I am your speaker, Casey, and this has been The Cult Vault.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line, prop, or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.